Down for your breakfast? You'll have to go back up again. If you rest, you'll get better faster.
Can I choose my egg?
Not today, pet. I'll go out and find you a nice brown one. Then I must go over to the manor to see Lord Julian. Anna smiled.
Before I got the measles, he told me I could call him Uncle Julian.
He did, said Maisie, trying not to betray her surprise. Anna nodded.
He came to watch me riding Lady, and he said I was showing great promise.
And that is high praise indeed, young lady. Now then, let's go downstairs. After breakfast, as Maisie predicted, Anna had become sleepy, though her colour seemed to have become more natural. As soon as she was settled in her bedroom once again, Maisie placed a telephone call to Priscilla, who confirmed that Tim would arrive at Shellstone Station at 12:20.
His cheek knows no bounds, Maisie. I heard him say to Tarkin, deliberately in earshot, I might add, keep your head down, Tark, she'll need a target if I'm not here.
And what did you say? Asked Maisie, expecting Priscilla's retort to be as filled with sarcasm as her son's.
I told him that Tarkin and I would be going to the cinema.
Because you know how much Tim enjoys the pictures. Priscilla, you two goad each other as if you were siblings, not mother and son.
I know. I should grow up. I suppose, if I am to be honest, there's something in me that enjoys the sparring, and at least I'm keeping him on his toes.
Or the other way around, Maisie sighed.
Anyway, I'll be at the station to collect him. He'll come home a lot calmer. He always does when he's been to Shellstone. Right, I'd best be getting on and find where Tark has got to with his head down.
Simmons, the butler, who had once worked for James and Maisie when they lived at the Ebury Place mansion, had seen Maisie walking across the lawns in the direction of the manor house, and had already opened the door to greet her.
"Good morning, your ladyship. How are you? And more importantly, how is dear Anna faring?"
Maisie smiled, warmed by the affection with which the child was held. Anna had come to them as an evacuee, and was later orphaned when her grandmother, her only living relative as far as anyone knew, died in a London hospital. "She's on the mend. Thank you, Simmons. She's very excited because Tim's arriving today."
"Oh, good. Another young person about the house is always welcome, and Lord Julian enjoys his company, too. The boy seems to hang on stories of Lord Julian's years in the Navy, which, of course, his lordship loves to tell."
"Speaking of whom, is he here, Simmons? I'd like to see him, if possible."
"Right you are. I believe he's in the library, but if you would oblige me by waiting just a moment, I'll have a look. He hates to be caught with his eyes closed."
"Good idea. And I'll nip into the kitchen to see Cook. She promised some more leftover chicken to make broth for Anna." Without doubt, Lord Julian had aged since the death of his son, though his upright bearing never seemed to change. Indeed, at the memorial service for James, held in the city at Temple Church, both Lord Julian and Lady Rowan seemed a head taller, with shoulders drawn back as if to represent the very strength and standing of their son. Maisie remembered trying to concentrate on James alive, James laughing, James running along a beach with a kite, and not the desperate yearning for her husband and their unborn child she had lost on a fine day in rural Ontario. Grief had been an oppressive weight that seemed to bear down upon her, until she regained some crucial part of her character while volunteering for nursing work in Spain. It was as if she had come home to herself and was given leave to open her arms to all that might be possible in the future.
"Maisie, lovely to see you, my dear," said Lord Julian, coming to his feet.
He had been sitting in a leather chair alongside the window. A book was open on a side table, its place kept by a weighted marker laid across the pages. He held out both hands, which she took in hers, and he leaned forward to kiss her cheek.
"And how is our young horsewoman?"
he inquired. "It's lovely to see you too, Julian. Anna is recovering well, and anxious to be out on Lady again. I think we might have to tie her to the bed.
As soon as she finds her legs again, she should be out there. Fresh air, the responsibility for a pony, nothing better for a child.
He extended his hand toward another leather chair, close to his own.
Now then, sit down and tell me how I can be of assistance to you. I'm sure you didn't come to tell me about Anna's recovery, though I'm glad to hear it.
Maisie smoothed the back of her linen skirt and sat down, leaning toward Lord Julian, as he too was seated. I'm curious about how the Bank of England goes about its business, not here in London, but now it's located in Hampshire for the duration. Have they moved their printing? Lord Julian sighed.
As you are aware, I am on the boards of various banks, so much of what I know is highly confidential. In a time of war, the supply and movement of money becomes even more crucial than ever. Money is a powerful tool, and wars are about powerful men and how they use the tools at their disposal. The military is involved in a number of ways.
Maisie raised her eyebrows. How? I never thought the generals would have communication with the bankers.
The Prime Minister, and thank goodness we now have a man who is up to the job of war, is the linchpin. He is the man in the middle, drawing to him everything he needs to secure the country to the best of the country's ability to protect itself and its people.
And what might the generals want from the bankers, and how is the PM a conduit between the two? Lord Julian looked at his hands, closed his eyes for a second, and then returned his attention to Maisie.
The Bank of England has to consider many factors in a time of war, not least the fact that the risk of forgery increases dramatically, not necessarily from local sources, but the threat of the Germans flooding the country with counterfeit money and bringing chaos to the economy is not to be underestimated. Interestingly enough, at the same time, money does not circulate in the same way. Rather, it is like blood around a body. And if the pressure on the system is high, blood moves a lot faster. We tend to see an increase in circulation, which means that, quite literally, paper money wears out faster. So, you have to have more in hand to replace notes that have reached the end of their useful life. Of course, there are people who slow down in terms of spending, and they save their money, not always in the bank, either. A tin box under the bed is often thought safer. If you have to run, you can run with your money. But on the other side of the coin, there can be a tendency toward profligacy. If we're all going to die, we can't take it with us when we go.
I confess I had never considered any of this.
No reason why you should, my dear. For most people, money is for saving, spending, or worrying about. Too much, too little, never enough. Money is the devil's tool.
He reached for a silver letter opener and began tapping it against his palm.
But with the threat of invasion, and it has never been more likely, the banks have quite literally been destroying money, though at the same time notes in different denominations have been deposited with clearing banks around the country.
So that's why, as you said, the printing, supply and movement of money is even more crucial now than in peacetime.
Yes, that's the extent of it.
He put down the letter opener.
And the Bank of England has moved some staff down to a location in Hampshire, given the risk of bombing across London. I can only tell you that money transported between Hampshire and London is an operation executed under a blanket of extreme security.
And what about the proximity of the coast, and Navy in Southampton and Portsmouth, to say nothing of the Air Force and Army in the area?
Our forces are in position due to the threat that has come from across the Channel since before Roman times. Even the Vikings came around to the south coast.
Maisie nodded, thoughtful. The War Office and Threadneedle Street are therefore close.
Very.
Lord Julian looked toward the door as if he expected someone to be there listening. He lowered his voice. Maisie had to lean forward to hear.
The Bank of England liaises with the War Office to ensure that any special notes required for military purposes are supplied in a timely fashion, and, again, under conditions of absolute secrecy.
He paused and looked out of the window, raising his hand as he smiled into the distance.
There's Rowan. I must be quick. She knows you're here now, so she will be bursting into the room in a few moments.
Another second's pause.
There has to be a supply for operations such as sabotage, intelligence, and for our airmen, who may find themselves in enemy territory after being shot down. They must have local currency with them, and we also have to pay the troops from our colonies, in which case it behooves us to have currency issued by British military authority, and in some instances those words are printed onto the currency. You will find there are notes available in sterling denominations that will never be available to the British spending public.
Maisie leaned back.
I had no idea.
Nor should you have any idea. It's a matter of the security of our sovereign land.
I have too many questions for the moments we have left to ourselves. She bit her bottom lip. But regarding another matter, I have the serial number here of a type of paint used to render airfield buildings safe from fire. Could you find out more about it? Maisie took the note from her pocket and passed it to Lord Julian. If possible, I'd like to know whether it's passed any tests for safety, and who manufactures it, where it's from.
I will see what I can find out, May.
There you are, darling Maisie. Where have you been? Lady Rowan Compton had not knocked before entering and walked with as much speed as she could muster, now that the arthritis in her hip was becoming more troublesome. She was accompanied by a spaniel and a Labrador retriever, both dogs bounding into the room in a direct line for Lord Julian.
"Rather busy this week, Rowan. You're looking well. Is your hip feeling better?"
"Oh, let's not get boring and start talking about health."
Lord Julian moved to stand to allow his wife to take his seat, but Maisie came to her feet.
"No, please, Rowan. I am just about to leave, so please take this chair."
Lady Rowan sat down with a loud sigh and rested her cane alongside the chair.
"Growing old is not for the faint-hearted, Maisie. Mark my words."
She rested her hand on her chest and caught her breath.
"I wanted to ask if you would come up to town with me tomorrow morning for the service at Westminster. George can drive us up."
"Of course. Tim will be here to keep Anna amused, and while she's asleep my father will keep him busy, and I can drive you up to town if you like. I left the Alvis here and I will need it during the coming week. You might have to come back on the train, though, if you wouldn't mind."
"Not at all, and George will pick me up at Tunbridge, so I don't have to shilly-shally around waiting for the branch line train down to Chelstone. I quite enjoy the train, so it will all be perfect. I'll be ready to leave first thing tomorrow morning."
Maisie waited on the platform, stepping back as the train from Tunbridge pulled into the small branch line station. Doors began opening and a handful of people stepped out of the train as others waited to board. She looked both ways along the platform to no avail. Tim was not among the passengers now holding out their tickets as they walked toward the station master, who greeted everyone by name. Steam punched out from the locomotive, and as the guard stepped forward with his flag, raising his arm and blowing his whistle to signal the train's departure, Maisie turned to leave the station.
"Someone missed the train?" asked the station master, touching the brim of his peaked cap.
"Yes. My friend's son, he's 16 now, and I think he's old enough to look after himself, but I so worry."
"Coming in from Charing Cross, changing at Tunbridge, was he?
Maisie nodded. He'll probably be on the next one. He pulled a pocket watch from his waistcoat, extended the chain to better see the dial. Maisie knew the station master would have been aware of the correct time to the second, but seemed to enjoy wielding his watch with a certain flourish.
The platforms are a bit packed on that line up from the coast toward. There are men coming back from France, you see, and the seats are taken until the next train comes through. Some of them are in a bit of a state. They've got the WVS out there handing tea in through the windows as the trains pull in, so the lads can get something down them. I heard they'd handed out a few hundred sarnies in just a couple of hours this morning.
Knowing Tim, he probably rolled up his sleeves and got stuck in to help, said Maisie. He can't wait till he's in uniform.
There's many a lad who couldn't wait the last time around, and then they couldn't wait to get home again. Anyway, better get on. Like I said, he'll most likely be on the 1 o'clock, due in at 20 past.
He laughed.
But I reckon you know the timetable as well as I do.
Maisie smiled. Yes, I'm sure you're right. I'll be back in an hour. She left the station and drove the 5 minutes back to Shelstone Manor. The station master said the up trains coming from the coast are holding up other services, she said, explaining Tim's absence to her stepmother. The Navy has been bringing home a good number of our soldiers, apparently. I'd heard that non-essential personnel were being sent back from France, and the trains were very unpredictable yesterday, said Maisie. Tim might well have missed the connection to Chelstone. Tim was not on the train at 1:20, 2:20, or 2:20. In fact, he did not arrive at Chelstone until long after Maisie had promised herself that she would place a telephone call to his mother. At 6:30, on the train that should have arrived 10 minutes earlier, Maisie felt a wave of relief wash over her as the tall, lanky lad clambered down from the third-class carriage and seemed to lope toward her. Priscilla was right when she had observed some months earlier. He's at that ungainly age.
"Tim, where have you been?"
asked Maisie, trying to keep the mixture of relief and irritation out of her voice. Priscilla's son leaned down to kiss her on both cheeks.
"I tried to telephone to Maisie, but it was rather chaotic at Tunbridge."
He ran his fingers through his hair.
"Does my mother know I'm late? She's watching me like a hawk these days, and I'll never hear the last of it."
"Had you not been on this train, I would have telephoned her, and she would have harangued me for leaving it so late to do so. I would have deserved her ire, because I put it off time and again. But the station master told me about the trains coming in from the coast, causing timetable delays, and it took me a long time to get home last night for the same reason. Now then, let's get you back to the house. Your bed's made up in the conservatory. You're the only person I know who can sleep with the sunshine beaming in first thing in the morning."
"I love the conservatory. Makes me feel as if I'm on a boat. Hearing the wind outside and the sunrise waking me up."
It was later, over a late supper, that Priscilla's son described the scene at Tunbridge Station.
"It looked as if everyone in the town was out there to help. There were women making sandwiches, brewing tea, and the men were helping to wash up the cups as the soldiers handed them back out of the train windows. I don't know how they heard about it and mustered all their help. I asked a guard, and he said that as some of the earlier trains stopped at the station, soldiers were leaning out and asking for water, so word went round and people started coming in with whatever they had to contribute. I'm telling you, Tante Maisie, the men looked terrible. Many of them were covered in mud, and a lot were bandaged up. I left my kit bag with a guard and just got stuck in to help, handing out food and water, bringing back cups. I asked one soldier. He was only about my age, well, a bit older, about 18, 19, more Tom's age, and he said he was lucky to get on a ship. He told me there are thousands of them, thousands of men trying to get to the coast and waiting to get off. The Navy's in there, sending over ships, but the Germans are bombing them, coming in with their Stukas. The soldiers I spoke to, think they'll all perish there. He was silent for a moment and stared out of the window into the peppery darkness of late May. Some of them were moaning that our RAF were flying right over, and then someone else pointed out that they were going deeper into France to try to slow down the German advance to give more of our men the chance to escape. Then another came back at him and said the RAF were going after the Messerschmitts over the Channel, trying to push them back. It's a devil of a fight. And there are our soldiers, completely stranded. It's terrible. They said they had no idea how the Navy would be able to get them back to England. They'll be left there. Like sitting ducks. Maisie stood up, came to her godson's side and put her arm around his shoulders. War is terrible, Tim, and you are so young to have to learn just how terrible it is. You know, Tante Maisie, we haven't heard from Tom for over a week. Mother is much too calm, but she's also sappy. I know. But she knows how she is, too, which is why she was keen for you to come down to Chelstone. She understands only too well what worry can do to her, so allow her some latitude. And you can cheer up Anna. She's come down with measles, though she's on the mend. I remember measles. It was horrible. Poor Anna. Now then, Tim, time for us all to go to bed, and your mother says you have work to do for your final school exams. Pointless work. Pointless when you know it's going on over there. It seems like that at the moment, but humour your mother and your father. They have enough to worry about. Tim pushed back his chair and began to help Maisie clear the plates. As they moved to the kitchen, he spoke again. Tante Maisie, you know you said I was too young to learn how terrible war is. Well, I'm 16. How old were you when you went to France? Maisie sighed. I was 17, Tim. Your mother was a bit older than me, but no more prepared for what we encountered. The boy nodded, though Maisie thought she saw his eyes redden, and he looked down as if to avoid her gaze. Tom will probably telephone tomorrow. Friday is usually his day, and he missed it. He turned, picked up his kit bag from the kitchen floor where he had dropped it as they'd entered, and made his way toward the conservatory. He did not look back, but called over his shoulder. Good night, Tante Maisie. Good night, Tim. Maisie stood for a moment and then went to the library. She still thought of it as Maurice's library. Even now she was at peace with the legacy she had inherited upon the death of her beloved mentor. It was to this room she would come when the ache of loss was most keen, and she yearned for the comfort of his wisdom. Now, with the house full, it was her makeshift bedroom. She poured herself a glass of sherry, and as she was about to take a seat alongside the fireplace, cold and covered with a needlepoint screen for the summer, she stopped and returned to the trolley that held the same two decanters as it had in Maurice's day. She poured a measure of aged single malt whiskey into a glass and set it on a small table alongside his leather wing chair. She clinked her glass against the glass she'd left for a man now past, and seated herself on the chair opposite. She took a sip of the sherry and leaned back. Oh, how I miss you at times, Maurice. How I miss you. And she waited for the counsel she would not hear, but would feel in her heart. Chapter 9. Maisie and Lady Rowan left Chelstone Manor early for the drive to London, as Lady Rowan would doubtless have been more comfortable had her chauffeur taken her to Westminster Abbey. Maisie concluded that, in accepting her offer, her mother-in-law probably wanted to discuss something without interruption and away from her home.
"Now we're underway, I think I can relax," said Lady Rowan.
"And I must say I do like your new motor car." "Thank you very much," said Maisie. "It's bigger than the MG, so easier to take the family out for the day, though, of course, when I bought it I hadn't considered the fact that we would be dealing with petrol coupons. I have to be very careful because I have an assignment that's taking me down to Hampshire now. It's a bit of a journey, and I cannot depend upon buses and trains when I get there."
"And it's not as if you can put your toe down and push this motor car a bit, is it?
I suppose it uses more petrol if you get too enthusiastic. Maisie looked across at Lady Rowan for a second, then brought her attention back to the road. I know you, Rowan. You would be tearing around the countryside if you had this motor. Rowan laughed.
I always liked a little speed, you know. The wind in my hair and the feeling that I could just drive off in search of something thrilling, if only for a short time.
The hip put paid to that, though. The wonderful hazards of riding horses diminished the years of excitement behind the wheel. And as you know, my son inherited the devil-may-care aspect of my character, which... She faltered.
It's something I very much regret. I wish he had been more like his father. More measured. More a thinking man than a doing man.
Maisie continued to look ahead, but chose her words carefully, for she understood her mother-in-law was perhaps making a confession of sorts. The James I knew and loved deeply had within him the best of both you and Lord Julian. He was also his own man, and he followed his heart.
He followed it too high that day, didn't he, Maisie?
Time has passed, Rowan. Time has passed for us all. It's taken me a good long while to reach this point, but I don't think it serves any of us to look back, tormenting ourselves with what-if and trying to change past events, if only in the imagination, can drive a person mad. Lady Rowan looked out of the window.
I love the way the mist comes off the fields in the morning, just as the day is warming up. It makes me feel as if the next 24 hours could hold the promise of something extraordinary, something new.
Maisie nodded, aware that the older woman had turned toward her and was now watching her as she drove on toward River Hill.
It was the me in him that caused him to make that bad decision, Maisie. It was the me in him that caused you to lose your child.
Maisie looked into her rear-view mirror to check the road behind, slipped down the gears, braked, and pulled over into a lay-by. She switched off the engine, turned to her mother-in-law, and reached for her hand. What do you want to say, Rowan? We've never really made the time to talk, just the two of us, and we've always skirted around what happened in Canada, touching upon it here and there before escaping to our respective corners. We've let fear of what might be said prevent us from saying what has to be said so we can be at peace, both of us. And I know only too well how time can cast a sort of skin over an event, a membrane that gets thicker until a point where broaching the subject is all but impossible, even when you think you can face the grief and terror once more. I did the same thing years ago with Simon, remember? Maisie looked down at Lady Rowan's hand, clasped in her own, at the deep brown liver spots and the arthritic thumb and forefinger. It was a hand that revealed a life lived to the full. I loved James for who he was, and he loved me for who I was. His death caused me to lose myself for a while, for years, really. You know that, but I am back. I am whole. And you do not need to make your confession to me, but I will hear it all the same. Your son loved his life, Rowan. He loved the man he became, and the man he was on the day he died.
But he was a bloody fool.
The older woman pressed her lips together and looked away.
That was bad language, but I am so very angry with my own son, and I've kept it bottled up because it's so hard to say that about someone I loved so much, but I'm so very disappointed in. I can't stand myself for the thoughts that go through my head sometimes, and when you were away for all that time, all I could think of was, James did that. She lost him and her child, and it's all his fault. And if it was his fault,
then it was my fault, too, because I'm his mother. I couldn't talk to Julian about it because the man is crushed anyway. There have been times when it has taken every fiber of our strength together to go from one day to the next, though it's become easier. But if I had the chance to do so, I would take my son and box his ears. Maisie shook her head. Oh, Rowan, James drew joy from the mystery of what each day might hold. He had come back from the dreadful years immediately after the war, and those years tormented him. That's all we should remember, that he loved his life, that he died as a man who was loved, a man filled with the promise of fatherhood, and of being involved in something so important to our country. It's something we should hold in our hearts, Rowan. Lady Rowan shook her head. I wish I could be so forgiving. Maisie sighed. What might Maurice say to you if he were here? Lady Rowan shifted her seat, though she allowed Maisie to continue stroking her hand. I wish I knew, she said, then changed her tone. Though I will add that he wasn't always right, you know? And there you have one thing he might have said, Maisie smiled. He would have reminded you that we don't always make the very best decisions. That is who we are, not perfect. Yet with our imperfections we are perfect human beings. That is who we are meant to be. James died doing something he loved, and we all adored him for his passion. He chose to be an aviator, and he chose to test a new fighter aircraft for the government. It was a fateful day, and it changed all our lives. Yet it serves no one to go back and forth, trying to apportion blame. Forgive yourself, Rowan, forgive yourself, and set yourself free of this blame, of regret. But you lost! Maisie shook her head and released Lady Rowan's hand, patting it as she did so. I am here today. She reached for the ignition and started the engine again. In Spain, I was reminded of all the losses people endure. Tragedy is so personal, but it doesn't mean it hasn't happened before, to someone, somewhere. It's what helps us to understand and bring solace to others, knowing something of what they feel. And look at the family I have now, you, Lord Julian, my father, and Brenda, and Priscilla, Douglas and the boys. And Anna, said Lady Rowan. Maisie felt the piercing blue eyes upon her, and another unspoken question hanging in the air. She slipped the motor car into gear. Yes, and Anna? The long, snaking line of people waiting to enter Westminster Abbey almost took Maisie's breath away. Unable to park near the Abbey, she pulled in as close as she could to the gates to allow Rowan to step out of the Elvis. She then drove off to look for a suitable place to leave the motor car, which she found just off Great Smith Street. She ran back to the Abbey to rejoin Lady Rowan, who informed her that because she knew people, there were already places kept for them, so they wouldn't have to stand. But as she was about to follow her mother-in-law into the Abbey, she had second thoughts. "Rowan, I'm going to join the queue. I want to stand with the crowd. You should sit down as soon as you can. Keep a seat for me, and I'll find you." Lady Rowan looked at the growing line of people. There must have been thousands of men, women, and children, and nodded. The king said it should be a national day of prayer, that we should come together as a people to pray to be delivered from the approaching tyranny. She cast her gaze back to Maisie. Yes, join the throng, Maisie. If my hip were not nipping at me, I would too. But it's one of those days when I must give thanks for the privilege of good connections and a reserved seat. I'll see you inside. As she was moving to the end of the line, Maisie heard a voice call out.
Oh, miss! Oi! Miss! It's us over here! Come on!
She looked into the line of people and saw Billy, Doreen, and Margaret Rose, all waving to her. You don't mind if the lady joins us, do you, mate?
Billy turned to a man and his wife standing behind them.
All right by me. The man stepped back. Come on, slip in here, love.
Thank you, sir. I am much obliged to you. She turned to Billy and Doreen. It's lovely to see you here, all three of you. She put a hand on Doreen's arm to emphasize her greeting and smiled down at their daughter.
Hello, Margaret Rose. Oh, my goodness, you've grown. You'll be as tall as Bobby soon.
The child looked down at her feet and ran her fingers through the halo of blonde curls that fell across her forehead, a mannerism that made her appear even more like her father. And when she raised her head, her cornflower blue eyes staring at Maisie, she said,
"Mum and Dad told me we had to come, because even if you didn't believe in God, you had to give him a chance when things get very difficult, and everybody has to pull together."
"Quite right," said the man who had allowed Maisie to slide into the queue, as Margaret Rose hid her face in her mother's skirts.
"From the mouths of babes," said a woman in front of them.
There was little time for a long conversation with Billy, but there was an opportunity for a brief chat.
"Is Bobby at home?" asked Maisie.
Billy sighed and exchanged glances with his wife.
"Yep, he's at home. Well, that's where he'll stay if I've got anything to do with it."
"Billy, he only..."
said Doreen. Billy shook his head.
"Nothing like having a 16-year-old know-all in the house, is there? He's gone and signed up to be a mechanic for the Air Force. Says it's not dangerous, that he'll be working on the aeroplanes, not in them. Well, that's all very well, but they could just as well send him up in time."
Doreen looked at Maisie and raised her eyebrows. Maisie realized then that the woman who had previously suffered such debilitating mental illness was now calm and was likely the one keeping a level head. "What do you think, Doreen?" The woman linked her arm through her husband's as if to chivvy him into a better mood.
"We've got young Billy over there in France, so it's easy to think Bobby should wait just a bit before he goes in for anything to do with the Army or Air Force or whatever. But one thing occurred to me, because we always call them young Billy or young Bobby, it's too easy to forget. They're men. They know what they want, and I don't think we should hold Bobby back. Not if this is what he's got a knack for. We can't expect him to want to work in that garage down the road forever, can we? And it's a good opportunity for him to get a proper profession with real prospects, isn't it?"
"It's a difficult situation, especially as Bobby needs your consent," said Maisie, drawing her attention from Doreen to Billy. "I know he's named after your brother, and you thought the world of him."
"Two peas in a pod, me and our Bobby," said Billy.
Maisie watched as Doreen bit her lip and turned away, then at once swung round again, her cheeks flushed.
"Mind, you haven't forgiven the fact that he died too young fighting over there, have you? But your son, our son, is not your brother. The way I see it, you have a choice. You can either acknowledge him and the fact that this is what he wants, it's something he has a talent for, and he landed this opportunity with no help from anyone, and that's no mean feat, Billy. No mean feat on the part of our Bobby. Or you can withhold consent, which means you can do something you were powerless to do with your brother, his namesake, and that is to stop him."
She had kept her voice low, but every word carried the weight of her frustration with her husband.
"The truth is, you could never have stopped your brother, because he knew what he wanted, and he wanted to prove himself to be a man worthy of his country's respect. Bobby is old enough to go to this Air Force college, to learn a new trade, and then to take up a new job. And if you're trying to save him, my love, just you remember how Sandra's Eric died. Poor girl lost her first husband when he was working on an engine in a small garage. There's no accounting for fate's timing. No accounting at all."
Billy was silent, staring at his wife.
"I've forgotten about Eric," said Billy, distracted.
Maisie stepped forward as the queue moved. She made no comment that might come between man and wife. They had almost reached the entrance to Westminster Abbey when she heard Billy break the silence with Doreen.
"Anyway, I'll think about it."
She looked round at the same time as Doreen leaned toward Billy for him to put his arm around her shoulders.
Right, said Maisie. We're almost at the door. I have to go in that direction now. Lady Rowan has saved a seat for me. I'll see you tomorrow, Billy. In fact, I can take you all down to Hampshire, because that's where I'm planning to go.
Oh, Margaret Rose and I are staying. We're not going to the country, said Doreen.
That's another nice bag of worms opened up just as we're about to go into a church, said Billy. Mind you, if there's an invasion, it might be better for my girls to be closer to London.
Maisie looked from one to the other.
Well, the offer's there. I can take you all if you wish. Anyway, Billy, we must speak tomorrow morning at the office in any case, about Archie Coombs.
Oh, yes, Archie Coombs. He's a different kettle of fish, no two ways about it. I've a few things to report on that young man.
Maisie opened the French doors that led into the walled garden from the sitting room, and went into the kitchen to put away the few grocery items she had brought back from Chelstone. She placed a bottle of milk in her new refrigerator, a half loaf into an enamel bread bin on the table, and poured a quarter pound of Brook Bond tea into the caddy. Slipping off her pale blue summer jacket, she hung it over the back of the chair, filled the kettle with water, and put it on the stove. Standing by the stove, staring at the flame licking up around the kettle, Maisie began to formulate a plan for the following day. Teddy Wickham, she wanted to talk to the young man who had decreed that Joe Coombs was on top form, and she wanted to see the place where the lad's body had been found. There had been no time to pay a visit when she had been brought to Hampshire to identify the body. She would have to speak to Detective Inspector Murphy to gain access to the area, but she had found him to be an approachable man, so did not envisage a problem with her request. She made her pot of tea, poured a cup, and set it on a small wooden tray along with a slice of bread and jam she had prepared while waiting for the kettle to boil, then went into the garden, switching on the wireless as she passed. Maisie had become quite used to the barrage balloons bobbing in the breezes high above, as if London had been prepared for a party, not a war. But the balloons were there to deflect an attack by enemy aircraft, not to entertain. Men and women in the anti-aircraft batteries would be scanning the skies, alert for radio messages signalling imminent attack. She had almost forgotten how it might be to see the underground stations without sandbagging to protect them. And as far as keeping her gas mask with her, like many of the capital's populace, she could not quite remember where she had last put it, and made a mental note to look in the dining-room cabinet. The drive from Chelstone, the service at the Abbey, along with the bobbing barrage balloons, seemed to have a soporific effect. It was from a dozy afternoon slumber that Maisie was woken by the telephone. She was rising from the chair when it stopped. So she sat down again, thinking it could not have been very important. A chill in the air wrapped itself around her arms, and she was aware that an announcement had interrupted music on the wireless, which had been beset by poor reception.
Owners of pleasure craft, able-bodied men with an understanding of navigation and offshore boating experience, are asked to report to their local police station. Those approved will, from Ramsgate, to France.
The announcer added that the same message had been broadcast several times that day. She shivered and looked at her watch as the wireless crackled and music continued. It was almost 6 o'clock in the evening. She had just picked up the tray when the telephone began ringing again, but this time she moved quickly to pick up the call. She was about to recite the number when she heard her stepmother's voice.
Maisie, is that you?
Yes, Brenda. Brenda, what is it? Is it Anna? Dad? Is everyone all right?
Yes, yes, your father's well, and Anna's all right, too. It's Tim.
Tim, what's happened?
He's not come home.
Brenda, what do you mean he's not come home? Where did he go?
It was after you left this morning. He came in from the conservatory just as you drove out of the gates, so must have been about 7. He said that he was going off to see a friend of his who lives in Rye.
I think it was Rye. Or perhaps he said he was meeting him in Rye. Oh, dear.
Brenda's voice became faint as if she were trying to remember exact details of the conversation.
Anyway, he said they were going hiking across the Romney Marshes. I asked him how he was going to get there, and he said it was all right. He'd looked up the trains, and he would get a bus part of the way, if necessary. I told him I thought he should let his mother know, but he just said, "Oh, it's all right, Mrs. Dobbs. She knows I'm going to see Gordon." He was in such a rush to get on his way, it was all I could do to make him wait while I packed up a sandwich box for him and made him take a bottle of ginger beer. If he's doing all of that walking, he would need something inside him, growing lad like that.
Priscilla didn't tell me anything about Tim going to see his friend Gordon while he was with us, said Maisie. And neither, for that matter, did Tim.
That's as may be, but he's gone, and I told him quite clearly that he had to be back by 4 o'clock or it wasn't fair to you, as you're responsible for him.
She sighed, but Maisie could hear it was an angry sigh, a sigh of frustration.
I don't think he liked it, being told that, but he said he would be back on the train that gets into Tonbridge at 3:20, so he would be back at Chelstone in good time. He left about 7:30, marching off with his knapsack, and he's not back.
Maisie laced the telephone cable around her fingers. Tim had been pushing against boundaries for a while, but he had never crossed a line with her. Yet she knew he had been shocked at seeing young men not so much older than him coming back from France. And Tim was a bright lad. He would have taken account of the steady escalation of news regarding the German advance and the precarious position of the army. A deep collective sense of emergency was being felt by the British people. The plight of our boys was a national tragedy in the making. The news reports were full of it, and Tim could have overheard his father discussing the situation. After all, in his position with the Ministry of Information, Douglas was privy to reports from military intelligence.
Brenda, did Tim make any telephone calls that I don't know about? He's usually very polite and will ask permission even to place a call to his mother. Not as far as I know, but...
But what?
Well, it was when you were tucking in Anna last night and reading her a story, before you sat down to a late supper with Tim. You were in with her for a while because you were putting calamine on her spots and bathing her eyes, those poor eyes, so sticky with this measles. And Tim said he was just going out for a walk across the field. He took Duke with him. Now, you know as well as I do that when you go over the stile at the other end of Topfield, you're at the crossroads, and there's the telephone kiosk right next to the bus stop.
The bus that goes to Tenterden, where you can change for Rye.
Oh, dear, said Brenda. Where do you think he's gone?
Maisie felt her heart beating almost to her neck. It's what he's done as much as where he's gone.
But where? He's only a lad, said Brenda.
Now, you mustn't worry, Brenda. I'll get him back. I think I know where he is. You look after Anna for me, and tell her Tim will be home soon.
Your voice, Maisie, I can hear it. You're frightened.
It's all right. Brenda will find him, one way or another. Now, I must go. I must speak to his mother.
Maisie, what joy, you're back. Of course I knew, because...
Priscilla was holding a cocktail in one hand as she opened the front door.
What is it?
What's wrong?
Let's go in, Priscilla. Is Douglas at home?
It's Sunday evening. Where else would he be but his study?
Call him, Priscilla, please. Priscilla ran to the bottom of the staircase and called out,
Douglas? Douglas? Come down. Now. It's important.
Maisie heard a door open close to the stairs on the first floor, and Douglas Partridge looked over the banister.
Maisie, lovely to see you. But what's going on?
I must speak to you about Tim, said Maisie.
In the hall, Maisie recounted Brenda's concerns that Tim had not arrived home on time.
Oh, that's all right. I'm sure he'll turn up soon, interrupted Douglas.
Priscilla shook her head.
Go on, Maisie. I can tell you're worried for good reason. Where do you think he is?
With his friend Gordon. Priscilla was about to counter, but Douglas interjected.
I know what Maisie's thinking. Yes, they live in Rye, and yes, they have several boats. As far as I know, a rowing boat, one of those slipper boats, a sailing yacht, and a motor launch of some kind. Perhaps two. Not sure if they keep them all in Rye, though. I mean, the man has a veritable fleet.
He turned to Priscilla.
Hasn't Tim sailed out of Broadstairs with them? Gordon has older brothers, all in the services now, I believe, and the father has a lot of money to spend on his passion, which is the sea.
Priscilla looked at Maisie.
Tell me, Maisie, where is he?
I don't know if you've heard the news. I only heard part of the broadcast because my wireless has such bad reception. But there was an announcement, a call for owners of pleasure craft who have boating experience. I don't know. But following the news lately, I think it's to assist in the evacuation of the expeditionary force from France. I imagine it's turned into an all-out push now. She paused, biting her lip, looking from Douglas to Priscilla. I doubt just anyone can take a boat and go. The authorities wouldn't allow it, but putting two and two together, I think Tim and his friend might have sailed out to find a way to join the flotilla gathering in the channel. I know very little about this, but Tim is so desperate to prove himself he would not think twice about it, and if Gordon's brothers are all in the services, I'd bet he's of the same mind. Priscilla turned to her husband.
Do we have the telephone number for this boy's parents? He's been down there loads of times. I'm sure we've spoken to his people. In fact, I had a word with his mother ages ago when Tim started visiting. I'll find it.
Priscilla pulled open a drawer in the hall table. She pulled out an address book with gold-leaf-edged pages and a burgundy leather cover. It was well worn, and when opened, Maisie could see names and addresses crossed out and rewritten.
Here it is. The Sandersons. The mother's name is Beatrice, that's it. B. Sanderson.
She reached for the telephone receiver and dialed, turning to look at Douglas and Maisie as she waited for the call to be answered. She picked up her almost empty glass and held it out toward Douglas. Her husband took the glass, but did not move. She raised her eyebrows, pursed her lips, and turned away. The call was answered.
Ah, yes, good evening. Yes, is Mrs. Sanderson at home? This is Mrs. Priscilla Partridge. Yes, with a P, like the bird. P-A-R-T, that's it, you've got it. May I speak to Mrs. Sanderson, please?
A pause.
Not at home. When might she and Mr. Sanderson return?
Another pause.
Not until tomorrow. I see. Did Gordon go with them, or is he at home?
She looked at Maisie, her eyes wide, colour draining from her face.
Yes. Quite. Well, if you've put two and two together, you will understand that Tim Partridge is my son, and Gordon is most certainly not a guest in my house.
She turned away again, facing the mirror. Maisie thought that, in regarding her reflection, Priscilla was keeping her spirit present, keeping her resolve rock solid so that she would not escape into herself as wave after wave of fear enveloped her. Priscilla continued.
You must find Mr. and Mrs. Sanderson soonest. I fear both Gordon and Timothy have told lies to be able to do something together. No, I cannot say what that something is before I speak to his parents, and you can't let me have a number for them?
Right.
If I do not receive a return call within the half hour, I will not be here to speak to them.
She turned to her husband, anger and terror mapped across her face, now flushed. She pointed to the empty glass while continuing to speak to the person on the other end of the line.
Please tell them that the boys have embarked upon a rather dangerous adventure. Here's my number.
Maisie turned to Douglas.
I think you ought to get her that gin and tonic, Douglas. She's about to start shouting. Then she'll break down. Priscilla slammed down the telephone receiver just as Douglas began walking toward the drawing room.
Can't he bloody see that when I say I need a drink, I need one? My son has gone off on a boat in the middle of the bloody channel, when for all I know his brother is in a piece of tin over his head, taking his life in his hands, trying to stop the German army.
Priscilla, stop, said Maisie, standing in front of her friend. Stop this right now. We have to think clearly. And Douglas had every right to listen to the call, because Tim's his son too. Not just yours.
But what can I do? How can we stop him?
She began to cough, tears streaming down her face, her eye makeup running across her cheeks.
It's happening again. My history is repeating itself. I'll lose them like I lost my brothers in the last war, all three of them dead. Where's Tarkin?
She turned to call up the stairs.
Tarkin, come down now.
Douglas emerged from the drawing room, a full glass of gin and tonic in his hand. Priscilla's husband had lost an arm during the last war, and walked with a pronounced limp. He struggled to manage his cane and Priscilla's drink, but his voice was strong.
Stop. For God's sake, stop and think, darling. Tarkin is not at home. If you remember, Eleanor was here and has taken him out. They're not due back yet. You can leave a note for them. Now then, first we should find out if we're completely wrong and Tim has just gone for a sail, or if he's really made for the French coast. Indeed, he could still be hiking across Romney Marsh. Well, of course he's gone to France, Douglas. Of course he has, said Priscilla. Maisie, said Douglas as he handed the fresh cocktail to his wife.
I'm inclined to agree with Pris, she sighed. I know very little about nautical maps, but I have an ordinary map, one that includes the coast. I've had a look at it, and I suspect that if Tim and his friend have indeed answered the call for seagoing craft, they would not have joined the flotilla in Ramsgate. I am sure the authorities have carefully registered boats they wanted to requisition. I imagine Tim and Gordon would have made their way out into the channel and slipped in with other vessels.
Oh, hell! I don't know where to go or what to do, but I know I can't stay here and just worry until he walks through the door, or until there's a policeman on the doorstep telling me he has bad news,
said Priscilla, her free hand on her forehead, as she lifted the glass to her lips and took several generous sips. There's little you can do, Pris, but if you must be on the move, perhaps you and Douglas should go down to Ramsgate and ask questions. Someone might have seen them, and if they come in, you can stop them. Douglas cleared his throat.
Maisie, you go with Priscilla. I will hold you up if I go.
Maisie watched as Douglas looked away, in an attempt to control his emotions. She turned to Priscilla, who was staring at her husband, her own eyes filled with tears. "I think you should discuss the situation," said Maisie. "You might hear from the Sandersons soon in any case, and all the worry might be for naught. If it is, then it's my fault, for which I am incredibly sorry. But I listened to Tim when he arrived at Shelstone yesterday, and he was full of what he had seen at Tunbridge Station as early evacuees from France were travelling through. In any case, I'll go and make ready to leave. Maisie turned away, though as she reached the threshold, she looked back to see Priscilla take her husband's outstretched hand.
Oh, Tim, you young fool, she whispered as she ran down the steps.
15 minutes later, Maisie had counted her petrol coupons and gave thanks that she had enough fuel in the tank to get to Ramsgate, though not enough for the return journey, and there was likely no petrol to be had on a Sunday. As she was loading a small overnight bag into the Alvis, Priscilla came running toward her along the street.
B. Sanderson telephoned. They've been in Reigate with friends for a Friday to Monday, but they're on their way back now. They've checked with a friend who lives close to where the boats are docked or kept or slipped or whatever it is they do with boats. And yes, it transpires that Gordon and a friend who happens to fit Tim's description went out for a sail early this morning and have not come back. But here's the thing. They took the larger